Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. Thanks for coming back on the show. We have a couple of big things I want to talk about. One with something happening overseas, another that we are seeing proof of the problem right here in Connecticut. So if you don't mind, I'd love to start with the conflict, the war that is continuing on right now between Israel and Palestine. First of all, what is your take on what's going on? I know this has been ongoing for so long, but what's happening right now has just been completely just devastating to watch.
Talking about what's happening right now, which is the latest chapter in a very long-running story, the humanitarian costs are simply intolerable on both sides. Women, children, men, all being injured and killed by the rockets that are being fired by Hamas from Gaza and by the strikes from Israel into Gaza. My hope is the violence will stop. I mourn with everyone in this country who shares the grief of people who have seen this humanitarian crisis, and I hope there'll be a ceasefire soon.
And Senator Blumenthal, I'm certainly not asking for you to give a perfect answer with a bow on top. But, you know, it's interesting from a news standpoint. I'm hearing both sides of this. In fact, just yesterday, there was a protest where President Biden came in. He addressed the U.S. Coast Guard in New London. And there were protesters saying, why are you giving all of this money over to fund Israel? And why, you know, because they were defending, obviously, the fact, like you said, there are women and children in Palestine who are hurting, and they do not agree with the president, you know, proposing millions of dollars going over there because they think it's funding the war. But then you have the other side where people want to know sort of where's the Democratic Party in this and how are we going to vote when it comes to defending Israel? So I know that's a very complicated situation I've just put you in, but I'm just curious sort of what your response is to both sides of this.
It is complicated, Melissa, and maybe the topic for a longer conversation. But the fact is, Israel has a right to defend itself, no question. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there has to be a ceasefire and a two-state solution, ultimately. And my hope is that there will be an end to the violence very, very soon. And, of course, everyone with any ounce of humanitarian feeling is mourning and grieving the losses on both sides.
And, Senator Blumenthal, I might be wrong, but in my research, is Hamas armed because of support from Iran?
Hamas is supported and armed by Iran. Absolutely right. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. Hamas is sending some of the most advanced missiles into Israel, stopped only because the United States has provided a defense system called the Iron Dome. Otherwise, there would be massive casualties and death in Israel.
So do you support the idea of sending money and weapons for Israel?
I've supported consistently providing defense mechanisms like the Iron Dome, providing other kinds of offensive arms. We provide billions every year by unanimous votes, by the way, in the Senate Armed Services Committee where I sit, unanimous votes. There has been bipartisan support for this military aid because Israel must defend itself in a very hostile and dangerous neighborhood. At the same time, there has to be progress toward a two-state solution. I've also supported the kind of aid for the Palestinian Authority that is necessary for essential humanitarian care and self-government.
Senator Richard Blumenthal is here. And Senator Blumenthal, you know, in what I've kind of seen from watching what's happening overseas and also what's being discussed in Washington, it does seem like I would agree. I do think progressive Democrats are kind of agreeing that we should be funding Israel. But I have also seen a number of Democrats not supporting this. So I'm curious, like, are you willing to go against your party to vote in support of this?
I've disagreed with some of the members of my party, but the overwhelming position of most Democrats is that Israel deserves support. And at the same time, I've never shied away from being critical of Israel. That's what friends do. They sometimes criticize each other. I have family there. I think the United States has recognized the bond with Israel, but at the same time, differing from time to time on settlements issues, praising the Abraham Accords, but criticizing perhaps on other decisions, just like Israelis criticize the United States. But we are allies, and I think the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, recognize their strategic value as an ally.
And I know that President Biden is in touch with Israel, is trying to de-escalate the situation. And I know you just said earlier in this talk that you're hoping for a ceasefire. How logical, though, is that? And I'm not dumbing that down. I don't mean that as disrespect at all. But I know, like, you know, we can hope and pray for a ceasefire, but this has been going on for decades. I mean, for a very, very long time. What are honestly the chances that they're going to de-escalate this and stop?
The chances are very, very good that it will be de-escalated.
Really?
There will be a ceasefire.
Why do you say that?
I believe there will be a ceasefire because of the pressure from the United States, from public officials here, most prominently the president, but others, members of Congress like myself. And I think that eventually there will be an end to this round of hostility. But longer term, there needs to be negotiations aimed at a two-state solution.
So would you say, Senator Blumenthal, when the Biden administration notified Congress of a proposed U.S. weapons sale to Israel, about $735 million earlier this month, do you think Congress will approve it?
I believe that eventually that military aid is likely to be approved, but it may hinge on what Prime Minister Netanyahu does in the next days in terms of de-escalating. I think there is a lot of feeling that Israel has made its point. Prime Minister Netanyahu has rightly identified Hamas as a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. He has taken the position that he wants to destroy a lot of the tunnels, the underground networks that enable Hamas to launch attacks on Israel. Israel has a right to defend itself, but at the same time, there'll be a point when he decides and Israel decides that they've achieved enough of their military objectives. I think that we ought to try to push for that decision to come as soon as possible. De-escalation and end to the violence are so important.
Senator Blumenthal, I don't know if you heard this story. It's kind of developing out of Monroe, but three juveniles are facing criminal charges after posting nude pictures of young girls on an Instagram account. In fact, some of the posts even include personal addresses of these victims. You know, to me, I think that this story screams just another reason why I personally think it's a horrible idea to create an Instagram that's meant for young people. I think it just takes younger folks down a very deep, dark online world that they just don't need to be in. And I know earlier this week you had made a push to Facebook not to create this new platform. Could you talk just a little bit about that and if you've had any contact with Facebook since making that push?
We've made the push that Facebook should stop, absolutely cancel its plan for Instagram Kids. That's the Instagram service or site that it's planning for children. For all the reasons that this Monroe incident is so repugnant, perpetrators and predators could have increased access to kids through this new Instagram site aimed at children. And certainly Facebook has shown that it deserves no trust from parents or anyone else when it says that it's going to protect children. That is about as empty a promise as I've heard, given the kinds of incidents already occurring on Instagram. So they collect information, they invade privacy, they use that information to market to kids, and they're also an entry point for predators to access kids. It's a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from Mark Zuckerberg or anybody at Facebook about, you know, what you and other senators have written in about these concerns?
We have so far received no response. I raised it in the committee hearing on Tuesday, a subcommittee hearing that I chair. It's the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection. Senator Markey and I are pushing for a response. He's the senator from Massachusetts who's been very active in this area along with me. We wrote to Facebook asking them to cancel Instagram Kids, but we've heard nothing back yet.
Is that platform, that's not created yet, that's just in the works, right, Senator Blumenthal?
Correct.
Okay. I mean, if Facebook ignores your request and goes forward and creates this, are there talks happening in Washington to figure out how to either help parents or help schools or help to educate your kids on the dangers of this? I mean, because Facebook ultimately is going to do, I guess, what they want. You would hope that they take the recommendations that are coming from our lawmakers. But if they don't and they just continue to do what they want, you know, what's our next steps? What can we do?
There is a lot of talk on both sides of the aisle about restricting the current immunity from any kind of legal responsibility that Facebook and other tech platforms have. I know that's a complicated sentence. What it means is they are treated specially under the law. They have an immunity. They can't be sued when people are injured by predators. For example, traffickers, which we corrected as a result of the bill that I authored that created an exception to this immunity so that victims and survivors of trafficking could sue the tech platforms like Facebook. But there's a broad principle of immunity. It's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And we are now moving toward reducing that immunity, that shield from legal responsibility, so people who are victims and survivors can take action against Facebook, Google, and others. But there has to be a broader review because consumers are often hurt when their privacy is invaded. Others are harmed by some of the practices that Facebook tolerates on its site. So we are spreading education and awareness, but also considering legal action.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you for the extra time this morning. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk again next week.
Talk to you then. Thank you, Melissa.
So the bill known as Jennifer's Law passed earlier this week, 35-1, a vote in the state Senate. And the bill was actually first introduced by Senator Alex Kasser. The big reason was to kind of change the definition, or I should say expand the definition of domestic violence here in Connecticut. And I'm so honored this morning for the first time on our morning show. We have Senator Alex Kasser here. Senator Kasser, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, Senator, what sort of led you to even realizing, hey, there's an issue here with the laws on the books. We need to change it.
Well, actually, you know that I represent New Canaan and Greenwich and Stamford, but I've been aware that domestic violence was an underreported but very severe problem across our state. And actually, as soon as I was elected, I met with domestic violence advocates, and actually police to find out, you know, what could be done to improve and protect victims. So that conversation started as soon as I was elected. And then, of course, on May 24th in 2019, one of my constituents, Jennifer Farber-Doulas, went missing and was presumably killed by her husband. So that just escalated the whole issue so many survivors came forward, told me their stories, and said, I'm just like Jennifer. Mm-hmm. My situation is just like hers, and I can't get the protection that I need for my children and for myself. So I really focused intensively on what the problems were and what the solutions were. And I spoke to domestic violence experts, legal experts across the country. Evan Stark, who was the person who put coercive control on the map with his book in 2007. Coercive control is an umbrella term for basically all nonviolent forms of abuse, because we know that nonviolent forms of abuse, like threats and intimidation and controlling someone's movements and psychological control and financial control, that those are actually, that's the primary method. Those are the primary methods that abusers use to control their victims. Like 90% of abuse is
really
that is coercive control. Yes. But it also leads to violence. So that's why it's so important to identify it early.
Senator Alex Kassler is here and was really one of the strongest, if not the strongest, voice in trying to pass Jennifer's law. Now, let's talk a little bit more about coercive control. Could you give us maybe like a concrete example? You know, I don't obviously want to name victims, but, you know, what would you say is like a common thing that they went through where they said, this isn't healthy. I'm not in a healthy relationship.
Well, yes. And we had, if people want to actually hear the stories of survivors and victims, they can look at the public testimony, the public hearing. We had nearly 12 hours of testimony from dozens and dozens of survivors, mostly women, all walks of life, all communities, and their stories were eerily similar. Mm. So coercive control can start out, it can start out in a very subtle way, where a partner says, well, I'm just trying to protect you. So I don't want you to go out at night, or I don't want you to go here, or I'm going to track your phone, or I'm going to track your car, or I want to read your text messages, or I want you to stop seeing that friend or that family member. And it becomes a tighter and tighter web of dependency, where another common thing is they can say, well, I'm going to pay the bills, and all our money goes into this account, and I control the account, and I'll take care of the expenses. You don't have to worry about anything. Well, then, of course, what happens is the woman doesn't have her own financial security. She doesn't have accounts in her name. Maybe he's paying the rent, and therefore that means, or paying either the mortgage, that means that all he has to do is threaten to stop paying the rent or stop paying the mortgage, and then she could lose her home. So there are all sorts of ways that may seem in the beginning like they are forms of protection, but they're actually forms of control. Mm. And women end up in situations where they want to leave, they want to get out of that relationship, but they know that the price for leaving is really, really high. Another very common thing that abusers do is they threaten to take the children. So, moms will do anything to protect their kids.
Sure. So. Yeah, the cost is a lot greater to leave than to actually stay sometimes in those relationships. At least that's how it seems. And again, talking to Senator Kassler this morning about Jennifer's law. Now, I mean, almost unanimously passed, obviously support on both sides of the aisle. But Senator, do you think the governor is going to sign off on this?
I certainly hope so. I haven't heard that he wouldn't.
Okay.
So, yes. I do expect him to.
And I know that this would now make, my understanding is, this would make Connecticut the 17th state to make such major changes to our domestic violence laws. Do you think that this will set a precedent? Do you think other states will follow suit with Connecticut?
Actually, this would make Connecticut the third state to codify coercive control. There may be elements of coercion that other states have in their law, but actual coercive control, the pattern of abusive behavior called coercive control, we would be the third state. And Hawaii was the first state last year, then California, and Connecticut would be the third.
Okay. Well, that's amazing. So you think, you know, that this is hopefully something that would catch on in other states?
I certainly hope so. And actually, what we really need is federal law. that establishes it in a uniform way across all states. So that's what I hope we will see. I know that there are discussions at the federal level, but we still have to work really hard to educate people. You know, one barrier is that a lot of victims don't identify as victims. They don't know. Mm-hmm. They haven't heard the term coercive control. You know, I hadn't heard the term coercive control, mm-hmm. and they are just fighting to survive every day. A lot of victims don't, you know, this is the thing, we have to change our mindset. Victims don't always look like victims.
Right.
You know, domestic violence is a lot more than black eyes and bruises. I mean, we heard testimony from Jennifer Farbadulos' neighbor, and she said, I saw Jennifer every day. She was always smiling. She was so loving and caring, an amazing mom. There was no indication on the outside. There was no indication that something was terribly, terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we need to understand, is that on the surface, it may look like someone has a great life and a beautiful house and a beautiful family and, you know, whatever. But that is not at all. That is not at all what's happening behind the scenes and underneath the surface. So that's why it's really important to give victims the ability to come forward and tell their what's happening to them in such a way that they can get protection from the court, so that they can then leave a relationship safely and quickly. That's really what this is about. It's about ensuring every person's human right to leave a relationship safely and quickly.
Well, Senator Alex Kasser, I so appreciate the work that you put into this, and I also hope that the governor signs this. I thank you so much for coming on, talking to us about this morning. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll talk again soon. And we are talking to Luke Frey of the Better Business Bureau this morning about rental car cons. Boy, Luke, it just never ends, does it?
Nope, never does.
Well, I mean, it keeps you employed, which is not, you know, something we're like touting. But, you know, at least you keep us informed and we appreciate that. So what are you finding at the Better Business Bureau when it comes to rental car fake companies, I guess?
Sure. Yeah. So there is a shortage of rental cars. So over COVID-19, almost all of the rental car companies actually sold off most of their fleets due to the high price of used vehicles to try to make, you know, extra money because people weren't traveling, you know, back during the heat of COVID. But now that people are, and it's basically going to be a travel surge this year, rental car companies don't have the inventory to keep up with everybody who's going to be traveling. So scammers are taking advantage of that fact and creating these fake third-party sites, I would say, almost like a Travelocity or, you know, a site like that, where you can book airfare and you can book rental cars and hotels all through this so-called fraudulent site. So a couple things to look out for. If you see any rental car deals this summer, I would say it is probably a scam, since I don't really see anybody getting a great deal on rental cars this year due to the sheer demand and low inventory.
And you know what's interesting about that, Luke, is the fact that, you know, we're hearing how commercial flights are at an all-time low because they are begging people to basically get on flights just so we could just up the revenue. So it's interesting that it's going to be opposite, because a lot of times people will rent cars when they land at their destination. So you would think, oh, I'm getting this great deal for my flights, which a lot of them are legitimate. Yeah. But then you think, I'm going to get a great deal for your rent-a-car, but that's not true.
Exactly. And people got deals on airfare. I traveled a couple times during COVID and it was dirt cheap. But I will say, if you're traveling into, you know, July, August, September, even October, you know, airfare is a bit more expensive than it was last year at this time. So, you know, last year, these long, long flights were like $100 round trip and it was like unreal. But, you know, now prices are going back up. You are going to be probably paying about full retail price to fly anywhere, since airlines know that people are actually trying to get back out there and want to go and want to travel, even hotel prices too. So even when it comes to kind of booking any type of travel, but especially rental cars, if you see any too good to be true deals right now, I would definitely be skeptical and, you know, do research on that website you're on or company or, you know, travel site you're about to book through, because a lot of travel destinations know people want to get back out there and prices are slightly going up right now.
And we're talking to Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau. Of course, another scam. Luke is letting us know about it, and we appreciate that. This time it's on rental car businesses. So what are you suggesting when it comes to contact information? So instead of just always using online portals, because we know in the pandemic, that's actually how a lot of travel companies have relied. Like, hey, don't, you know, let's free up our phone lines, use online. But you're saying with rental cars, it's probably a good idea to just call them directly?
Yeah, definitely. So if you are going to book any type of rental car, I would suggest renting and booking directly through those rental car companies, not using any of these third parties, since you could run into a couple issues where a third party site might think they have that inventory and they actually don't. So 2 days leading up to your trip, you could get an email saying, oh, by the way, your car has been canceled since, you know, XYZ doesn't have the inventory, and then you're out of car, you know, 2 days prior to actually going on your trip. So I would book directly through those companies. And if you are going to a third party, that's when it's important to see what contact info you can find. So if it's only some kind of form online, if you have an issue, that might not be your best bet. You always want to book through a third party that you can easily get in contact with if you have any issues. So try to find some type of phone number that you can call if you book through a third party.
And I would think, Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau, that's also a good idea when it comes to deals online. Like, you should probably just call to verify that there are actual deals.
Oh, definitely. I mean, if it's any type of travel deal and any third party site, definitely call. But again, if it's a site that's not so trustworthy, you know, talking to a person may not even help you in that sense. So I think just doing research, you know, checking BBB.org, doing a quick Google search, seeing if anybody else has booked a trip on that site, booked airfare, booked a rental car on that site and had any issues is an important step prior to doing any type of purchasing online.
And Luke Fry, I'm just wondering, beware of sponsored links. What does that mean? And what do those look like?
Sure. So a sponsored link is basically if you do a search. So say you're going on a trip and you need a car and you Google cheap rental cars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what is going to pop up at the top of your search are sponsored links and or sites. So a couple of those could be fraudulent sites trying to sell you cheap rental cars, but also even on social media too, you know, sponsored Facebook post ads or even on Twitter, you know, after you Google that you're going on a trip, you're going to see ads for rental cars, hotels, you know, and keep an eye out for those ads you see. If it's a deal that seems too good to be true, you've always got to look into that company prior to making a purchase.
Now, Luke, I know you have a full list here with the Better Business Bureau of things to look out for if people are going to be renting a car anytime soon, booking earlier rather than later. Where can people go to learn some of these tips and also to use your scam tracker?
Sure. People can go to bbb.org/news, and that's going to take you to our latest news articles about traveling, about rental cars, and then also our scam tracker. So if you think you're in a scam, if you have been scammed, you can always go to our bbb.org/scam tracker and kind of do a search and see if that company or person you are talking to is on our BBB scam tracker and has scammed some other person. And if you have been scammed, tell us about it so that we can learn about how these scammers are evolving and changing all the scams that they they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we appreciate all this information. Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau, always a pleasure to have you on. We'll talk in a couple of weeks.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Luke.